them as caregivers of when a family member is diagnosed with ALS. So '69, and I don't know if anybody even knew about it, and Lou Gehrig, the New York Yankee baseball player, gave it a name when he was diagnosed in 1939, and I think the public largely considers this disease Lou Gehrig's disease. And because it afflicts so few people, it's not the kind of disease that's attracted a lot of research money. At any given time, there's about 450 people in Minnesota that have this disease. About 2 new people are diagnosed every week, and about 2 people die. So the 450 number is pretty constant. So what this bill is what we're hoping to do is provide some money and there for ALS research here in Minnesota. We've got some incredible institutions that do research both at the University of Minnesota and at the Mayo Clinic, and they're doing some trial work now, and we're hoping to just be able to enhance this. Both in the U and at the Mayo and at Essentia up in Duluth. We got 3 sites in Minnesota that are participating in a national trial program for ALS. There are 50 sites around the country, 3 of them happen to be in Minnesota, that are doing these ALS trials. And what they tell me is, and the trial program's actually being run out of University of Massachusetts at Boston, they're the lead agency in it, that because this trial program is so broad across the country with about 800 participants in it, that they can cut the trial time in about half and the cost by about a third. So there is work going on in this area, but there just hasn't been enough. And wouldn't it be something if Minnesota was the place where a cure for all or some forms of ALS were to happen? And I just think about how innovative Minnesotans have been over time. You know, Minnesotans changed the health of the entire world with our medical device industry, with the pacemakers and defibrillators that were invented here, and our medical device companies continue to do that. But there's other innovations that have been part of Minnesota's history, and we're the ones that invented snowmobiles and water skis and rollerblades and scotch tape and sandpaper and post-it notes. So Minnesotans have been pretty innovative, and I'm hoping that Minnesotans with this money find a way to advance the ball on research to make the lives of people who are diagnosed with ALS better. I will never forget the day that Senator Tomasoni came to me last June and told me he had been diagnosed with ALS, and there's nothing anyone could do. No treatment. And so I view the bill as a bill of hope, that maybe someday when someone is diagnosed, there'll be some kind of a treatment regimen to at least provide some hope for you, that your life can be, you know, better going forward and not just a certain decline. So, Madam Chair, that's kind of what I have to say. I don't know if Senator Tomasoni has anything additional to add, but we do have 2 amendments and an oral amendment.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Or Senator Bach, excuse me. Before we get to the amendments, I do think Senator Ingridson, we have an oral amendment on the bill, and
Madam Chair, we do. I'd like to offer the oral amendment, and Mr. Nauman can help me if he needs to. But on the second page line of the original bill, 2.4. Change the July 1 date to June 30th, June 30. And Mr. Nauman, I think that's correct.
Madam Chair and
Mr. Nauman.
Senator Ingebertson, just to clarify, on the base bill itself, the first engrossment, line 2.4, strike July 1 and insert June 30th. The rationale for that is so that it doesn't cross fiscal years, doesn't force MMB to do an additional coding for one more year. It's just a little bit technically easier on MMB.
Any questions on that oral amendment? I'd like to adopt that first. No? Good. All those in favor of the oral amendment by Senator Ingebrigtsen, please say aye.
Aye.
All aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Oral amendment is adopted. And then to the A3 amendment, members, it's in your packet.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Ingraham.
Madam Chair, I would offer the A3 amendment.
Okay, do the A3 amendment. Senator Bach, do you?
Well, Madam Chair, the A3 does a couple things. First, it provides some guidance to the Office of Higher Ed and the Department of Health about what kind of criteria they should look for in an application for research grant funding. That's something that they asked for, that we'd be a little more clear about what the criteria they'd evaluate applications around. And then in the bill, we had looked at giving them $150,000 a year for the cost of administering the program. We don't think it's going to cost quite that much, so we delete the $150,000, and we give them a lump sum amount to run the entire program of $400,000, so that's a savings in the administrative cost. And then there was discussion, and I think we all agree, that when people make applications for these grants, that the different people doing research have some synergy between them or are coordinating the research, that research isn't duplicative in any way. So that's the other piece, to make sure that we give some preference to approving grants where people are coordinating their efforts and not duplicating the same kind of research. And then the final piece is a report to the legislature on the outcomes of the grant program annually.
Thank you, Senator Bach. Any questions on the A3 amendment? I don't see any. Senator Inkerpritzen renews his motion on the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And then we have one more amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Inkerpritzen.
Madam Chair, I offer the A4 amendment, and this amendment has a little more of a lengthy amendment that needs a fix, if you will, and I'll turn that over to Mr. Nauman, if I could, for the exact verbiage.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair and Senator Ingraham, I believe it reflects the author's intent on line 2.6 of the A4 amendment to insert a sentence at the end that reads, "This is a one-time appropriation and is available until June 30th, 2026. I think that reflects what Senator Bach would prefer.
That's correct,
Senator Bach.
So that it doesn't, we don't want this appropriation to cancel at the end of the biennium. So it'll run concurrently with the research dollars.
And the dates match up with the original bill. So, okay. Any questions on this amount of money?
Madam Chair, that would be the amendment with the oral.
Senator Ingraham-Britson incorporates the oral amendment into A4 amendment. Members, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Bach, I do have a question. You know, there has been a lot of discussion about University of Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic, the research that's being potentially there. I do think the A3 amendment does address some of that. Can you just explain a little bit who, it is quite broad, right? Even though the grant will be going through the Office of Higher Ed to award the competitive grant? Have you talked about how that's gonna work?
In conjunction with the Department of Health.
Okay.
So it's not the Office of Higher Ed by themselves. And that's why we had to add in the A3 amendment the language kind of clarifying what we wanted the criteria to be for the applicants when the applicants' applications are evaluated, so that we make sure that we get, for lack of a better word, the best bang for the buck in the research area. I can tell you, I've heard from both the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic, they want to work together on this. I've got a letter from the Mayo Clinic that I received yesterday. They're pretty excited about this. Okay. So it's just an area that's been hard to attract funding because it's such a small cohort of people. And there's been a great deal done through nonprofits and the philanthropy, but that's a hard word for a ranger. But I mean, for example, that National Healy study that's going on right now, and I want to thank everybody who donated to Never Surrender at Senator Tomasoni's event last week, because Never Surrender, in order to
to help pay for the cost of getting a trial group in Duluth so that the geography wouldn't prevent people from being able to be in that experimental trial. Never Surrender is a nonprofit. Donated $500,000 in order to get a trial location located up in Duluth. So there's a great deal going on with this by people riding snow. Kent Herbeck, who's testified a couple times, has been doing a fishing tournament for 20-some years. His dad died of ALS. He's really taken that on as a cause. Same thing, there's a big snowmobile ride up north that raises a lot of money, about $1 million a year in charitable contributions. So there's been things going on, but this bill is, they've described to me, as a game changer for the University of Minnesota and the Mayo and others that may want to do research on this.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we had to know somebody near and dear to us that is being sacrificed in order to have this in front of us, this bill. And I am going to allow Senator Tomasoni to speak here in a minute, but I do want to mention that Dr. David Wolk from the University of Minnesota ALS Research is online if there are any questions that anybody has. So, no, okay. And I do want to mention too that Senator Housley has worked and has a bill very similar to this, if you'd like to mention that.
Madam Chair, thank you for bringing that up. The caregiver support programs that we've incorporated into the bill are actually out of Senator Housley's bill. She had an ALS bill also with $20 million for research that came from the ALS organizations, and it had caregiver support grants. And I can just tell you, if you had been at the press conference that we had on this bill and you saw Representative New speak about what her young family went through when her previous husband was dying of ALS, it was pretty moving. And they need some, those families need some additional support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very compelling. Senator Tomasoni, would you like to say a few words? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chairman, thank you for hearing this bill, and thank you to Senator Bach for carrying the bill. Thank you also to Senator Housley for carrying a similar bill. Members, Lou Gehrig died of ALS in 1939. Little to no progress in finding a cure has been made since. This bill is a concerted effort to find a cure for ALS. ALS is a neurological disease that saps the strength from muscles and ultimately leaves chaos in its wake. In September, I was still driving and able to dress and feed myself. Today, I can't do any of them. The disease progresses differently in different people and is very hard on caregivers. Hopefully, this bill will go a long way to finding a permanent stop to any progression whatsoever. It may not happen in my lifetime, but the future needs to be full of hope that next generations will be ALS-free. Thanks to the co-authors and all the support everyone has given to me and my family all along the way. Thank you, committee members, and thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. We all adore you. Any questions for Senator Bach?
Madam Chair, I've been surprised when this issue has kind of come on the front burner for me, and as you network with people, how many people have family members or neighbors or friends that have been afflicted by this? And I guess we just didn't know. I was reminded last night, the mayor of Duluth is in town for Duluth Days, and she said her stepdad died from it. It's just amazing how many people. There's an obit in today's Iron Range newspaper from a ranger from Senator Tomasoni's district who was diagnosed in December, and his obit's in today's paper. Mm-hmm. So it does, to Senator Tomasoni's point, people are affected differently. Some people, it's very rapid. And then others might live with this for a number of years, and we just don't know why that's the case. So I'm looking forward to putting our best minds in Minnesota to work to try and provide some hope for the families that are afflicted by this.
Thank you, Senator Bach. Okay, no further questions, comments. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to remind us also that we lost another colleague to Lou Gehrig's disease just about a decade ago with Senator Kubley, who I think we all felt the same thing. To have two members of the Senate stricken within a decade is a tragedy, and I think this is an appropriate way to try and prevent others from going through this too. So thank you, Senator Bach and Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Senator Marty, for that. Yes, Senator Kubley, many of us served with him. He was a wonderful, wonderful senator. Also, Senator Thompson, I think you owe us donuts, actually. Now that I think about it. So, Senator Ingebrigtsen, would you like to?
Madam Chair, I'd be honored to move Senate file 3372 as amended to pass and go directly to the floor.
On that motion, all those say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you,
committee.
Okay. Members, we're going to move to our completion of the February forecast with Commissioner Showalter and Dr. Colin Bakitis and Anna Ming. We got to page 7 in our pamphlet. And I believe that would be okay. Here we go. Who's on deck?
Thank you, Chair.
This is
Jim Schultz for the record. Thanks for having us back on this significant day. I just appreciate the discussion of the bill that just was discussed. I just wrap up the budget and economic forecast conversation. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Colin Bakitis. I think we were kind of midstream in looking at the economy and revenue forecast and a lot of the important considerations that are in it. I just really appreciate the committee diving into it. I think what you're seeing from this conversation is just the depth of analysis, the number of hands and issues that go into it. And while people want to look at the one number, obviously there's a lot of issues and learning that are potential here. So with that, Dr. Colin Bakitis, let's pick it up where we are at. Lyle, if we're able to slide it down a few slides. I think we just had a little bit of a glitch there. So, but Dr. Kay, would you mind just sort of reintroducing where you're at?
Good morning, Dr. Colin Bakitis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks, Jim. While we get the slides up, and Lyle, when you get there, let's go to the first employment slide, the unemployment rate slide. So I had been talking about U.S. economic outlook and how it changed since November, and then we also had updates from IHS's March outlook. So I had talked about that as well, and so I want to move to talking about Minnesota's labor market. So Minnesota's unemployment rate had fallen as of December to 3.1%. That's 0.9% below the U.S. unemployment rate and the 12th lowest among U.S. states. So it's a sign of recovery in Minnesota's labor market as well as the U.S. labor market. This is quite a dramatic drop in the unemployment rate from the spikes of spring of 2020, when Minnesota's unemployment rate reached 11.3% and the U.S. reached about 15%. We're working on getting our slides back up, so be patient with us on that. I always present the unemployment rates and compare Minnesota to the U.S. because it's a good way to looking at those aggregates and averages can be a good way to compare Minnesota to the U.S. and look at trends over time. But aggregates and averages can mask important differences among groups. And one of the things the overall unemployment rate doesn't capture is Minnesotans who have left the labor force. And that would be for retirements, and for leaving to care for children, for those who are staying home to take care of children. Since the onset of the pandemic, Minnesota's labor force has fallen by 87,000. As of December, our labor force participation rate, our labor force participation rate is the share of the over age 16 population that's in the labor force, that was 67.7%. So that's 2.5 percentage points lower than in February of 2020. So it has fallen since February of 2020, and the labor force participation rate has been, had been even prior to the pandemic, expected to gradually fall as our population ages and as the baby boomers age out of the workforce. But as of December, it was 67.7%, 2.5 percentage points lower than prior to the pandemic. But the state's participation rate remains high relative to the U.S. So Minnesota's participation rate is always higher than the U.S. and is usually among the top few amongst of states. And that relationship between Minnesota's labor force participation rate and the U.S. has remained robust. So our labor force participation rate is 5.8 percentage points above the U.S. and the sixth highest among U.S. states. So, and as with the U.S. forecast, you recall we talked a bit on Tuesday about overall wage growth, about wage and salary income growth in the United States. And we said that IHS expects a tight labor market in the U.S., so low unemployment, high demand for labor. They expect those things to drive up wages in Minnesota. We expect that, I'm sorry, to drive up wages in the U.S. We expect those same conditions to drive up wages in Minnesota. So low unemployment and high demand for workers. So the unemployment rate, you can see at 3.1%. We also have in our last job vacancy survey from Deed, we had a record number of open positions, job vacancies statewide. So very high number of job vacancies. There are more job vacancies statewide than there are unemployed workers, people looking for work. There are about six workers, people looking for work for every 10 vacancies statewide. The next chart is a different view of the labor market. It's employment. So it's the line chart showing the levels of employment. So if you can move to that next chart, that would be helpful. Thanks. So what is this? So this chart is not a growth rate chart. It's just numbers of workers in jobs. And we're just showing the top of the graph, and we're just showing since the last recession. And so the growth that you see from 2009 up to 2020, that's the fairly steady employment growth that Minnesota had since the last recession. But you can also see, if you look carefully at the top, just as we get to the 3 million mark in 2020, in February of 2020, you can see that the slope of that line is starting to level off. That means that our employment growth was slowing. I think we talked about this last time, that due to slower labor force growth, because of the aging of the population, our employment growth was also slowing even prior to the pandemic. And we were talking about a tight labor market. We were talking about more jobs available than available workers. We were talking about strategies to try to retain older workers, to try to attract workers. That was all happening prior to the pandemic. Then in the spring of 2020, the pandemic takes hold, economic restrictions are put in place to slow the spread of the virus, and we lose 416,000 jobs in the spring. We have since regained 307,000 jobs through December of 21. And so our remaining gap is 109,000 jobs, which is 3.6% fewer jobs than in February of 2020. So that's the gap we have yet to close.
Dr. Kalambakidis, we do have a question. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Dr. Kalambakidis, question I have, of those 109,000 fewer jobs remaining to date, what categories are those? Are they service sector? Where are the jobs that have not been regained yet?
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm looking for a chart that might have that. So of the, let's see. So if you look at the industries that lost the most jobs in the beginning of the pandemic and the recession, this is on page 34 of our forecast book, those were accommodation and food services, healthcare and social assistance, et cetera. Those have, so the accommodation and food services sector lost 47% of their employment right at the beginning. So between February of 2020 to May of 2020. From February of 2020 to December of 21, they have since recovered to a loss of 7%. And so looking at magnitudes, so that's a significant recovery, but they still are below their pre-pandemic levels. So there are significant number of sort of missing jobs or fewer jobs in accommodation and food services, healthcare and social assistance area, local governments, at least this was as of December. So that's not the same as job vacancies. Those are sectors that are still trying to recover the jobs lost. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Sir.
Yes, it does answer my question. I think it points up a fact. One of the other things is in the private sector, so it's largely the private sector that has not yet recovered, especially those small businesses, service sector, I would suspect restaurants, small business of a variety of sort, but anywhere you have a service industry. And so that is yet to recover. So large businesses have seen that, but we have not seen that strength. And yet our unemployment is 3.1. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic that we have going on here, where we have low unemployment and yet there are still jobs to recover as well. But that gives me a good idea. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Kolumbakidis, I'm not sure that you have the charts in front of you or anything, but I'm just curious if you went back three more years to pre the last recession. Was that curve, I assume it fell more slowly than the COVID one did, but what was the recovery like? What was the curve like prior to 2009? Where was it? How high was it before? How fast did it fall? How fast did it come up?
Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Madam Chair, Senator, that is a very interesting question. I do not have that in front of me. But what I can say about the previous recession is your intuition is right that the fall was not nearly as precipitous, of course. We've never seen anything like what we saw in the spring of 2020. So that sharp, sharp drop did not occur. It was more of a long, it's more of a U than a V. And I don't want to speculate about the shape of the employment recovery because I simply can't remember it at the moment. But we can put together a chart like that and send it to you.
Madam Chair, just kind of curious if there are any lessons to learn from it, but it sounds like it's so much different. But if you do have something easily available, I'd love to see it.
Sure.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Doctor, I don't know if you can answer this, excuse me, answer this or not, but I'm led to believe that the per child income from the federal government, I believe it's the federal government, still applies. In some family, of course, a family of three, that's $900 per month. So I don't know if you know that that's still going on, and if it is, would that or would that not have something to do with the 300K jobs? It just seems like that's something that's significant, and if that makes a difference, or would you have any of those kind of numbers at all?
Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think you're asking about the impact of those additional federal payments on families and on their decisions of who's going to work and how much to work and what that might have to do with the employment recovery nationwide and in the state. Am I right? That's
correct.
What you're getting at? Yeah, it has been very hard to parse out exactly what the impact is of each piece that is affecting household dynamics, household labor dynamics right now. And it's possible, it's likely even that the additional pandemic unemployment benefits from the federal government and the additional payments for the child credit payments, that those are things that gave families more options than they might have otherwise had, and could have changed their employment decisions. The thing is, there are so many other things affecting employment decisions right now that it's just impossible to exactly pinpoint that. For instance, we still have volatility and uncertainty with regard to schools and childcare. And so that's a factor in decision making with regard to going back to work or leaving work. In addition, we have, remember, so we were talking about, it's those face-to-face service jobs that are having a hard time catching back up. And those still have health concerns associated with them. And so people have been, might have had additional caution about going back to those jobs. So I can't say that there is, that I know what the impact is of those child payments, just that lots of families have had their decisions about the labor market disrupted by the pandemic and by the federal response to the pandemic. And I think it'll be a long time before we actually know how that decision-making has fundamentally changed.
Thank you.
Senator Pratt.
Madam Chair,
good. Dr. Kolumbakidis. We are done with questions.
Oh, isn't another question?
No, he passed.
All right, Madam Chair. Let's see. All right, so let's move to the revenue forecast. So this table shows, the first column shows our current forecast, our February forecast for revenues. The second column shows the forecast change. Since November, general fund receipts have exceeded our forecast. And so that means since we did our November forecast, we have taken in more money than we had expected. And that's, for those of you who follow our revenue reports carefully, that what I'm saying that is net of the timing shift we had with regard to the pass-through entity tax. So even aside from the pass-through entity tax timing shift, we collected more money than we had forecast in November. So that's one of the reasons that generally a forecast will go up. Those higher tax receipts to date in fiscal year 22 and the improved outlook for the things I've talked about here, income, consumer spending, profits, those raise the revenue forecast for 22 and 23. So total general fund revenues for the current biennium are now forecast to be $1.252 billion more than in the November forecast, and we raised the forecast for all the major tax types. Individual income tax receipts are now forecast to be $498 million more than the prior forecast. The changes to the biennium are front-loaded. 70% of that occurs in 22. Higher growth in wage and non-wage income, especially business income and capital gains realizations in 21, raised the income tax forecast for the remainder of this biennium. And I just want to add that that non-wage income, so business income, so Senator Kiffmeyer has been talking about the profits of small businesses, of pass-through entities. Lots of households also have capital gains realizations. Those factors are very volatile. And hard to pin down, and that's some of the reason why the forecast for the income tax went up for this biennium.
Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Sales tax rep.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry. The 1.252 was what we will be working with. However, there was a change in the individual income tax of 322, I believe it was. When is the revenue forecast change? Does that come out today, or?
Madam Chair, first of all, Are you talking about the error in the income tax model?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. First? Yeah.
And so we were briefed of that here. Yes.
Yes. So most of that amount is in 24-25. There's was I think 92 million of the error is in fiscal year 23.
Okay.
So for this, it's that 92 that is affected in that is affects the current biennium, and then the remaining 270 or so is in 24 and 25. And yes, today we get you'll get the revenue report for the month of February. We're still finalizing that.
Okay, and I guess I would like to ask you, has there been, since we last saw you a couple of days ago, and since everything is moving very fast here and globally, any other changes that you've seen or expect? I mean, we had the federal government was talking about pulling back on the SFRF money, and then they rescinded that with a couple hours later. Members, are you familiar with all that? That was quite the drama yesterday afternoon. Because we have $1.13 billion money, ARP money sitting on the table, and that could have been clawed mm-hmm. back.
Madam Chair, so that last issue is not something that I'm particularly familiar with, but I'm sure the committee members are. The conditions are changing, as you all can tell. The conditions are changing daily, hourly, weekly. And, you know, just impossible to fully grasp and forecast. You know, yesterday we had this raucous day in the stock market and oil prices came down. And today there's more, I haven't had a chance to look, but there's more volatility in the stock market. So, and we have a meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee coming up. And there will be reactions around that, even though they have telegraphed what they're going to do. So yes, things are changing. We are watching it. What we can't do is, you know, with each of these incremental changes, there's always there's an action and then there's a reaction. We don't know what all the federal government is going to do with regard to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. We don't know what the full extent of the impact on the financial system is yet, or on the US economy, or even on the European economy for sure. So, updates. The updates I can give you are the monthly forecast from IHS we talked about yesterday, that they have brought down their forecast for real GDP this year, and they've brought up their forecast for inflation this year, which I think you all expected to see happen. And then on the 10th of every month, we'll report our revenues. So to be clear, the revenue report that you get today is February, and so it's during the period that we're processing. Department of Revenue is processing early income tax returns. There isn't, you know, we don't get the big story for income tax returns until the May report.
Okay.
I think it's a little too early with this revenue report to say that, you know, it necessarily has something to do with the changes in the macroeconomic.
Okay, yes. Thank you. And Dr. Columbakidis, I did make mention to what happened yesterday on the federal level. I think I'd like to turn to Mr. Nauman just to give a brief update to the members on that.
So, Madam Chair, with your recommendation, I'll give a brief discussion there. As members know, the State Fiscal Recovery Fund comes to the state in two segments, one last May, and we're anticipating another segment that would be allocated from the federal government this May. The House of Representatives in Washington had a provision in the Consolidated Appropriation Act, which it passed yesterday, but before passage, there was originally some language that would have rescinded from those states that have similarly situated with two segments allocated to the states, with rescinding about $7 billion of the amount that remains. Ultimately, that was removed from the bill, and it will not affect the states, but there was a fair bit of national swirl over that yesterday afternoon.
And I'm happy to go into greater detail if any members have any questions.
Yeah, Mr. Nama, could you tell us what was at stake there?
I left that part out, Madam Chair, because we're not entirely certain. There's some language. We think the floor would have been for Minnesota in over $200 million of SFRF money, but we're not entirely certain.
And the ceiling would have been the entire amount?
I think that's probably a little high, but okay. Yeah. Okay. There was some amount that was at risk. It really, depending on how the language was read, it would have affected different, it's potential that there was a potential that actions by some states would have affected our state and our action could have affected other states because it was a total amount that was then allocated amongst the states that were similarly situated, of which there were 29. I know that I'm being very vague here, but the good news is it didn't happen. Fair point. I'll just leave it there. And if there are additional questions, I'm happy to go into detail.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Kalambakidis, for that interruption.
Shall I go ahead?
Yes, we're good. No questions.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thanks, committee members. And if when I hand over to Budget Director Mingy, she may be able to answer more questions about that issue if you need to. Back to the revenue forecast, sales tax revenue is forecast to be $212 million more than the prior forecast, and that's consistent with a higher amount of higher forecast for nominal consumer spending that I mentioned earlier. Nominal meaning inflation is included in it as opposed to real, which means it's corrected for inflation. So a higher forecast for nominal consumer spending and higher than expected collection so far in fiscal year 22. The corporate tax is projected to generate $324 million more than the prior estimate. That's based on the higher forecast for corporate profits that I talked about before and higher collections so far this fiscal year as well. So similar stories between the sales tax and the corporate tax. So my last slide is reiterating risks to this forecast. I'm not sure we need to go into these in any more detail. We have talked at length about inflation and about energy prices. And of course, the geopolitical conflict that we allude to here is the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but all of the repercussions following that, including the sanctions on Russia and whatever it is that other countries end up doing, including the US as a result of this. Those supply chain issues that were risk in November, those of course are exacerbated, not improved by conflict in Europe. Underneath all of this stuff, we still have the path of the pandemic where the news has been positive lately, but we do not know what the impact might be of additional variants of the virus. And then just my normal caution that we produce this forecast 16 months ahead of the end of the biennium. And so a lot of this revenue that we're talking about has not yet been collected. And even small changes in percentage growth rates in volatile income sources or important income sources. So I talked about business income and capital gains. Those are highly volatile. Those can change a lot. I talked about how important wages are. That can change. Even small percentage changes in those things can have a large impact on the budget picture for this biennium and the next. So I'm happy to take any more questions. If you have them, or I'll pass the baton to Budget Director Mingy.
Thank you, Dr. Kalambakidis. No questions. Thank you so much for your time. We really, really appreciate having a one-on-one like this with you, Dr. Kalambakidis, and you indulge us quite a bit, so we appreciate that. Thank you.
And it's my pleasure.
State Director Mingy. Welcome to the committee. You've been very patient.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. I'm Anna Mingy, Budget Director with Minnesota Management and Budget. We can go to the next slide. I will be walking through changes in the spending forecast and then providing the committee an overview of our long-term budget outlook, looking out into the 24-25 biennium. So as we move to the next slide, this chart includes a table that details spending changes by the major bill area in the current biennium, fiscal years 2022 and 23. overall spending changes are relatively small, about 0.5% lower this biennium than the November forecast. The first line, E12 education, E12 is the largest area of the general fund budget. And there we are reflecting $158 million, or about 0.8% lower spending than November projections. And this change is due to several factors. The largest driver of the change is lower spending in, for special education transportation. And this program saw lower actual costs in the 2020 through 21 school year. And this forecast picked up those final costs. And this was as a result of more special education students relying on remote and distance learning options. The forecast also reflects some lower spending due to fewer than expected pupils. And most of the savings is due to updated final enrollment data for the previous school year. In addition, the forecast reflects lower payments for compensatory aid, resulting from fewer applications for free and reduced price school lunch. This is primarily due to pandemic-related federal support for nutrition programs, where students could receive a free meal without the need to submit an application. The next line, Health and Human Services, spending is forecast to be $108 million, or about 0.7% lower than previous estimates. The largest driver of this reduction is additional federal Medicaid funding as a result of the extension of the federal public health emergency. As members are well aware, as a result of federal legislation passed 2 years ago, Minnesota receives a 6.2 percentage point increase in its federal matching rate for Medicaid for quarters in which there's a public health emergency related to COVID-19. In January of this year, the federal government extended the public health emergency into April of 2022, which allows us to capture an additional quarter of that enhanced match, which results in about $143 million in additional federal contributions to Medicaid. However, those savings are somewhat offset by higher costs to the state, as we're required to maintain continuous coverage for MA enrollees. So on net, the extension results in a savings of $65 million to the general fund. I wanted to note, this forecast does not reflect savings from the increase, on Tuesday, Senator Benson asked about an increase in Minnesota's underlying medical assistance match percentage, and that savings was reflected in the November forecast. So we're not seeing that change on this table. Moving on, in the Health and Human Services line, this $108 million in savings in HHS also reflects $40 million in savings due to lower use of the state's child care assistance program as a result of lower caseloads during the pandemic. However, those caseloads are expected to return to pre-pandemic levels by the end of fiscal year 2023. Spending for property tax aids and credits was $15 million, or about 0.4% lower than previous estimates, just as a result of fewer homestead credit refunds and renters' property tax refunds in the current year. Projected debt service costs are relatively unchanged from November, and you can see that all other areas of the state budget combined had a forecast increase of $12 million in higher spending compared to November estimates. This change reflects a transfer to the 21st Century Minerals Fund, as well as increased firefighting cost forecasts of the Department of Natural Resources. So in total, in the current biennium, spending is forecast to be $270 million lower than November estimates. However, the bulk of these changes are one time and don't continue into the planning year. To move on to then look at those planning years, this chart illustrates the structural balance in our general fund forecast. You can see in 2022-23 and 2024-25. And what structural balance really is comparing our projected revenues to expenditures. In the current biennium, we have a projected structural balance of $5.56 billion. And in the planning years, the structural balance grows to about $6.3 billion. This reflects that revenues are projected to grow 2.8% on average annually, and spending is projected to grow 2.5% on average annually. MMB also always includes in our forecast materials an estimate of the impact of inflation in those planning years. And with this forecast, we estimate that the impact of inflation in 24 and 25 would add about $1 billion in increased cost to the state budget. This does not reflect a change in inflation in the current biennium, as the, we have an appropriated budget for fiscal years 2022 and 2023. With that, I don't know if there are any questions on the expenditure forecast.
Thank you, State Director Mingyi. Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Director Mingyi. With the inflation issue, you're mentioning how it doesn't affect this one because we have the budget for this cycle. But if the inflation is much higher than was projected in the past, then in effect the spending, like for schools, instance, they have less to deal with because they have higher inflationary costs. And that inflation that's happening now affects the next one as well. Is there any way that one can calculate what that impact is? In other words, from, say, 2 years ago, the inflation increase, that affects this cycle, obviously, though the budget's already been appropriated, so they have to deal with it internally. But then the next cycle, it still affects there, and even with this $1.09 billion, that only takes effect the inflation from this current cycle to the next one. Is there any way to calculate, because it seems to be there's a loss to the, like the schools and the budget for education, seems to me there's a loss in the higher inflation they're facing now, which carries over into the next. Is any way to roughly estimate what that impact would be?
Director Mingyi.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I think that's a really interesting point, and there certainly would be a way to approximate that. I think there, you know, as you understand, it would be a really complicated exercise. There are a number of assumptions we need to make about how the inflation in the current biennium is flowing through into to expenditures. But one possible way would be to look at how actual inflation has compared to previous projections of inflation and carry that increment forward into the planning years. I don't have that analysis completed, but we're happy to have additional conversations with members.
Madam Chair, I understand the complexity of that, but I think I would appreciate additional conversations about that.
Senator Kent. Her hand was up first, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow on Senator Marty's point, I also think it would a simple way of looking at it would be to evaluate what our percentage inflation increase was in the budget we passed, which I recall was 2.2. I may be off by a quarter for a year here and there, with what we're seeing actually. I think that's actually probably more meaningful to the schools to see where the shortfall is from what we thought we were providing them and what actual inflation has been. So just a thought.
Thank you, Senator Kent. Senator Pratt.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Kent kind of made my point, but you know, as we talk through this inflation number, Ms. Mingyi, when we get the governor's budget from MMB every biennium, you've estimated what those rising costs are going to be, haven't you?
Director Mingyi.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, the governor's budget may include additional, you know, the governor recommends funding increases for state agencies and state programs. And in this case, we've been discussing education. And that it does not necessarily attempt to estimate the changing costs as much as the recommendation for increased state support.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But that increased state support inherent within that number is the the inflation of cost or the deflation of currency, correct? I mean, there is a rising cost that has to be. We're not just talking about it on real terms. We're talking about it on nominal terms, right?
Director Meehan. Director Meehan.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator, the governor's recommendations around education spending do not always align with our inflation forecast. So I'm sorry, I don't. I hope I'm understanding your question. There are. There's certainly a calculation of anticipated cost growth, but it does not necessarily align with our forecast for expected inflation. And I'm sorry, I was going to make another point, but I lost my train of thought. So is that
Senator Pratt?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Meehan, and maybe I'll just let me try it again. You know, when the legislature and the governor put together their budgets and their increases, we're looking at it as both an increase in real terms and an increase in nominal terms, with the nominal already capturing the underlying increased costs. Senator Kent said there was a 2% or more increase in education, which was meant to cover in part some of that inflationary expectation. And I'm presuming that the governor does the same thing. He's looking at rising costs and what we need to increase on both the nominal and real terms. And I'm just saying that's part of the biennial budgeting process. And I was just looking for confirmation of that, but I think I asked the question in way too complicated a way. So my apologies.
Director Meehan.
Madam Chair, I think you're correct that to the extent the governor or the governor would recommend an increase in funding, generally that is for these gen ed formula increases intended to address rising costs. However, it does not always align with expected inflation, and there are a number of ways that districts could manage those rising costs.
Senator Murray.
Madam Chair, I think that gets back to, again, the fact that I think we have a flawed law where we require them to factor in factor in the inflation in the budget forecast. And the governor's budget may or may not address the inflation. Our budgets may or may not address the inflation. And I just think we ought to take a deeper look at that. And I hope we can repeal. I've got a bill, if you want to hear it. I've got a bill that would remove the ban on counting inflation, because no accountant is going to figure out the inflation on one side of the equation, but not the other. And yes, our budgets and the governor's budgets may or may not reflect that inflation, but I think this points to one of the flaws in that law. It makes it a difficult thing to do, and I think you were talking as if, of course, the budgets take that into account, and they do to a certain extent, but not necessarily.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you know, Senator Marty brings up a good point. I think the point that I was trying to make was that we look at inflation and we look at real cost, and sometimes it's not just an automatic inflator to the cost, that we make rational decisions on additional efficiencies that are in programs, or you know, if there's a real need that matches the inflationary increase, and all those are taken into account. As I heard Budget Director Meehan and the point that I was trying to make is those are our decisions as we're looking at increases in total. And just to say that here's an inflationary number without taking into account changes in programs, changes in efficiency, changes in across the board, those are all rational decisions that we make as we're making those budgetary biennials. And so I think we have addressed inflation as we go through our budget process.
Senator Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a question for probably Mr. Nauman, or it could be the testifier as well. Is there any portion of our budget, any agency area, that does have an inflator?
Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, there are a few in the Health and Human Services area, in the special education in the K-12 area, has an automatic inflator baked into it. It's my understanding that for the last 3 or 4 years in MMB's calculation in the forecast for inflation, they have excluded those inflationary, those particular items in the budget that are automatically inflated.
Thank you.
And Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I understand Senator Pratt's point about trying to count in inflation, but again, I'll point out the Senate education bill last year was $150 million increase, not counting inflation. Counting inflation, it was $515 million. So in effect, what looks like an increase to us is actually a deep cut. And in the end, the budget, when the House and governor and everyone weighed in, the end thing was basically keeping even with inflation. But the point is, I think a lot of people here vote for a bill they see as an increase when it's actually a significant cut vis-a-vis education, vis-a-vis inflation. And so I think that that's why we're just confusing ourselves by having our bookkeeping done in, it's a cooking the books kind of strategy to count the inflation on one side, and as Mr. Nauman pointed out, in some parts where the budget automatically goes up because of inflation, we count those, but most of the budget we don't. And like education was the difference, 150 versus 500 million. And so I think if we all have the 500 million is right in there in the forecast, here's what is likely to be the higher costs the schools face, then we know, and we can decide we're not going to do that much or we're going to do more. But I think it's just confusing the process when we count the inflation only half the time, which is why I think this is such a major issue.
Senator Kim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and I want to thank Mr. Nauman for reminding me the details for what we did do this current biennium. A 2.45% inflationary increase in the general education formula in fiscal year 22 and 2% in 23. And, you know, generally in my experience and having sat on education for a lot of years, we make a good faith effort to try to support our schools with an inflationary increase. And we'll just stipulate that's exactly what we did when we passed our budget last summer. And lo and behold, inflation is quite a bit higher, and that's what our schools are experiencing. And what we've seen when you look at the charts over the decades, that happens inch by inch, and to the point that I believe it was Senator Columbakidis, I mean, Ms. Columbakidis made, Dr. Columbakidis, earlier, small percentages have big impacts, especially over time. And that's what we have seen in our schools. And so in this particular moment, I think it's a conversation we do need to have, and we should be looking at what those real impacts are to our schools. I know that the Association of Metropolitan School Districts just did an analysis, and an awful lot of those school districts are looking at pretty serious budget deficits for this school year. And that's being felt by our kids at a time when our kids are already struggling. Because of the learning disruptions, because of the medical disruptions, because of mental health challenges that have surrounded this entire pandemic. I would also say, just to Senator Marty's point about changing the way we do our budget, 2 points. First of all, I remember when I explained this to my local Woodbury area Chamber of Commerce business owners, and I explained the Minnesota law and the way we do our budgeting and the way we define a surplus or a deficit, and they were floored. They would never run their businesses like that. Their looks on their faces when that kind of registered with them was like, you do what? And then the other thing that I want to say, going back specifically to education, but I think it's true across the board, we spend so much time every 2 years debating 2%, 1.5%, 2.45%. That's really what takes up all the oxygen and all our energy and all our time. And if we could just make sure that we had inflation accounted for our schools, think about all the time and energy we could do to talk about exactly what Senator Pratt was talking about in terms of making sure our policies are as strong as they could be, making sure that we are finding the efficiencies that we need. But instead, we put all of our effort just trying to cover inflation. Just wanted to share those couple of thoughts. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Kent. You have served on E-12 for your entire service here, correct? Yeah, absolutely. Okay, any further questions for Director Meagy? No? We're good? Thank you so much, Director Meagy, for your time and attention. I know it was difficult to bring you guys all back after But I thought it was a great discussion, and I think we covered a lot of territory, so we have a big responsibility this year. With that, members, there will be no hearing on Tuesday at all, but we do have some other work and possibly Wednesday or Thursday morning. So just stay tuned with that if you don't mind. Okay. With that, the Senate Finance Committee is adjourned. Have a good weekend, you guys.